Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Conversation analysis, CA, is an approach to the study of social interaction that empirically investigates the mechanisms by which humans achieve mutual understanding. It focuses on both verbal and nonverbal conduct, especially in situations of everyday life. That definition of conversation analysis gets us into the study of a host of human interactions, criticizing, storytelling, apologizing, and joking, among many others, that reveal the relationship between the participants in a conversation. You may detect many of them in the conversation to follow. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me are Cecilia Ford, English and Sociology Professor Emerita at the UW-Madison, and Doug Maynard, Professor of Sociology Emeritus at the UW-Madison. And welcome both of you to University of the Air.
Thank you for having interest, and I hope we interest your listening audience as well.
And we can get into this. We were talking just a couple of minutes ago, in fact, before we went on the air, about the difficulties, the intricacies of being in the room with somebody you're talking to versus not being able to see them, whether they're on the phone or even in a Zoom conversation, not quite the same. Well, let me start then by asking each of you in turn how you got involved in this study of conversation analysis.
Well, I grew up with a love of cultures and languages, having lived in many cultures and learning many languages before I was the age of 12, at which point it got more expensive for my father to take us along on his professor's salary. But I reached college, and I realized that I just wanted to study about languages, not only learn them. And I couldn't conceive of language as a system being studied outside of context. And fortunate for me, I went to a state college in Southern California, Cal State Northridge, which didn't yet and never has since developed a linguistics department. It only had interdisciplinary studies of linguistics, and I took many courses over the course of my bachelor's degree. When I decided to complete my BA, I had to complete it and get out of there. But I could graduate within a year in many subjects wherein I studied the major subsections of linguistics, study of sounds, which is called phonetics and phonology, and the study of language or word formation, which is morphology, and the study of grammar, putting words into, like, sentences, syntax. But from there on, I studied field methods in learning about other languages, which was housed for the first half of the 20th century in anthropology, not linguistics. Linguistics just developed in the mid-20th century. So I was lucky in that I studied language sciences, which is now a department or program at the UW-Madison. But I studied it interdisciplinarily, and I benefited from that to no end.
Well, I still remember from an anthropology class I took. I think it could have been English, though, the way you talk about it. could have been any number of disciplines, but I remember this definition of language as being a system of arbitrary vocal symbols through which members of a community interact.
Yeah.
And even then, you know, they were kind of tinkering around. You got into phonemes and the minimal unit of sound and that kind of thing. So
I'm surprised that they defined it as interaction through which people interact, because as I encountered it early on the in the 1970s, it was just made up sentences and written language. In fact, a person, a Swiss scholar, Swedish scholar, Per Linnell, writes about it, this under the written language bias in linguistics.
As opposed to spoken.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doug, you're busily cogitating over there as to what got you into this study of conversation analysis.
Well, I come to conversation analysis by a very different route from Cece. First of all, I was by way of college training and then experience, work experience after college. I started out being an industrial engineer, and but I was unhappy in that profession, and I wanted to do something that was of more intrinsic interest to me, and I began looking at sociology, and eventually went back to school and got the equivalent of an undergraduate degree in sociology, and therein I discovered both symbolic interactionism, but also another subfield called ethnomethodology. And what ethnomethodology is, I will define in a moment, but I want to say about sociology as it is conventionally practiced, is very much about statistics and, in a sense, correlating background characteristics of individuals with various kinds of outcomes, whether it's educational attainment or even criminal behavior or what have you. And so it's looking at human behavior in terms of such things as race or ethnicity or social class or gender or those kinds of things. But that kind of sociology doesn't give you access to what life is like on the ground, how life is actually lived in the social groups that we all live in. And so ethnomethodology, you can get even from the term ethno, is about members, and the methodology part means to study how members of any social group methodically put together in real time, in real life, the characteristics of the social group that they live in. So it's a field that's very much about social life as it is lived. And then conversation analysis developed in relationship to ethnomethodology through several individuals who decided to turn on their tape recorders whenever they were in a group, or actually this was a time of landline telephones, and it was a time when you could listen in on other people's conversations, and they took advantage of that.
That's here for those party lines, yeah.
Yeah, they recorded telephone conversations. You could never do that today, even if the technology existed, but they did that and then began listening carefully to those conversations, transcribing them, listening more and more again and again until patterns began to emerge. And so I got interested in, because I was already keyed into social life as it is lived, I was attracted to conversation analysis because it really provided a number of tools whereby you could map what people are doing in real time, in real life, so to speak.
Well, until 150 years ago, though, all those conversational transactions would have been person to person, not on the phone or some other mechanical means. And doesn't that affect the conversation right there? Because in some cultures, for example, it's more acceptable to encroach upon the other person's personal space when you talk. And in other cultures, if you do that, that person is going to back up and feel intimidated.
Yes.
So don't you really, to get the whole story, have to be right there in real time when the conversation takes place?
I think it's helpful, and it certainly has become a major component of the field of conversation analysis to study gesture and body movement and what we call basically embodied conduct. But so much happens in talk that even beginning to use talk as a source of investigation and how things get done in talk as a topic was revolutionary in its own right. And as time has gone on, more and more it's become an investigation of talk as it is done in and through the body and with other kinds of gestural mechanisms.
Yeah, I would add that videotaping technology was not that available to the originators of CA, conversation analysis, and it became more and more available to now that we can use our telephones. But in my lifetime,
for better or worse.
In my adult lifetime, it's gotten much more reasonable to access language in its natural habitat of spoken face-to-face interaction. After all, that's what language evolved in the midst of, activities and practices that people did in groups and not just one-on-one. I think Doug will have something to say about the packaging of information into packages and sending it to another person, the conduit metaphor.
Right. Well, Cece and I had talked about how we could distinguish what we do from other ways of understanding what conversation is. And one of the favorite metaphors, in fact, for what conversation is it's called a scholar by the name of Michael Reddy called it the conduit metaphor, that talk or conversation involves having thoughts and then figuring out how to package your thought in words and then send those words down to conduit, and then your recipient unpacks those words and figures out what it is that the speaker meant in the first place. And so different from that in conversation analysis, different from the conduit metaphor, the orientation is very much towards how words and how utterances, in fact, perform actions in their own right. They're not conveying something else. They're not conveying thoughts as such. They are performing actions. And so you could say that conversation analysis is the study of social actions, plural. And we could name hundreds of social actions that we all know how to do. Just a few of them are things like greeting as a social action. Asking a question is a social action. Inviting somebody to go for dinner is a social action. Delivering news is a social action. And the list could go
telling
on
a
on.
Joke.
Telling a joke, absolutely. And there are studies, conversation analytic studies of joking.
Well, one question comes to mind in terms of studying these conversations, though, and that is how do you do it without intruding upon the natural flow of this conduit or, to use the other example, the conversation, the forming of the words? How do you do it without intruding as a researcher?
Yeah, that's a good question and one that frequently comes up for our studies and for our data gathering methods. And one answer is that turn-taking is so automatic. I will talk about that if we have time. But it so rule-governed and so embedded in our online interactions that we can't control it because of camera or microphone. It would be some people orient to the camera and say something to the camera, but normally during their conversation, when they're playing a game or cooking dinner or talking to a patient and doctor-patient interactions, they go about their business and don't make their awareness known to the camera. And what we are investigating is so basic. We've not gotten to the point where we could analyze how people are being stilted or somewhat
formal for for the camera or the microphone.
Yeah.
And yes, I would just add to what Cece is saying is both of us have recorded in various kinds of what we could call formal settings or that kind of thing, meetings, business meetings, doctor-patient interaction, and those kinds of things. And what you can notice is that initially when somebody is set up with a mic or a tape recorder or a video camera, they're self-conscious to begin with. But as time goes on, they lose consciousness of being recorded because the dynamics of the social interaction take over. And it's safe to say that they're not in that sense affected by the fact that they're being recorded. There's a second matter I wanted to bring up, which is that we also are studying how the participants themselves show understanding of the dynamics that are going on. They show understanding of the meanings. As I was saying before, this is the study of social action, and the participants in various ways describe or are in situ analysts of the social actions that they're participating in. So a very strong methodological orientation in conversation analysis is to get a hold of participant displayed understandings and meanings as they occur in the talk.
You mentioned also, Doug, a little earlier, this idea of the word itself being an action. How does that work?
Utterances are actions, meaning that, and we have an illustration here. We can play the recording, meaning that when I produce an utterance, it is doing some kind of social action, but it's not naming the social action that it's doing. So it doesn't come with a definition. An utterance doesn't come with a definition attached to it. And but yet participants both produce utterances knowing the action that they mean, and recipients of utterances hear the utterance as doing a social action. We can illustrate this with a recording.
Hello?
Marcia.
Yeah. Hi, Donnie.
Guess what?
What?
My car is stalled. Got him up here in the glen.
Oh.
And I don't know if this is possible, but see, I have to open up the bank at in Brentwood.
Yeah, and I know you want, and I would, but except I've got to leave in about 5 minutes.
Okay, then I got to call somebody else right away. Okay?
Okay, Donnie.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye.
So this is a call between two friends or at least acquaintances, and one party, the male, his name is actually Donnie, is calling Marcia, and he is essentially, as a social action, he's making a request. But he never says that he's requesting something. He doesn't say, I have something to ask you. He doesn't say, I have something to request of you. All he does is report his circumstances. But Marcia, his call recipient, knows perfectly well that he's asking for help. Marcia, for her part, is in some kind of circumstances where she can't go out and help him with his stalled car. But here's the paradox is she never says no. She gives her reasons for why she can't help. So you have a request reply sequence in which the participants are doing social actions that they never name. This has to do with our common sense. We understand these things because we are common sense actors. We know how to produce social actions without doing it in so many words. We know how to respond to other people's social actions without also doing it in so many words. And yet we understand each other perfectly well.
And we've learned that through our lifetimes of being in interaction.
Kind of a code.
Yeah. There's a social action at the very beginning of this recording known as a summons answer sequence. The summons is constituted technologically because it's the ringing phone. And if you know how strong of a social action is or how strong a social action can be, you can relate to that by how when a phone is ringing, no matter what you're doing, you're very tempted to interrupt whatever you're doing in order to answer it.
Witness, we have our phones turned off during this interview.
Exactly. So it begins with the ringing phone and the answer when Marcia says hello, and then it goes on from there.
An everyday conversation. And so we get the idea that this sort of thing happens a lot when somebody is just kind of reaching out, I suppose, tentatively for some kind of a response and a little too nervous about actually asking for it straight out. And then the other person kind of is embarrassed about not fulfilling that unspoken response and just wants to kind of get out of the conversation as quickly as possible.
Exactly. What's fun is when I'm teaching is to play this call and ask the students, what's going on here? And they will come up with, you know, an analysis that's pretty close to what a technical conversation analyst would say about this, because they also are common sense actors. But it's a lot of fun. We do that a lot in our teaching, Cece and I, just playing recordings and asking people to analyze it on their own terms.
And we, about this conversation, we don't just get embarrassed, but we avoid saying no outright. We hem and haw, and those are actions in themselves, hesitations and apologies and things that Donnie says right then. I would, and I would like to.
But I got to leave in 5 minutes. Yeah. So you give an excuse, and that's also constitutive of the refusal action.
Yeah. You know? You don't avoid, you avoid saying just no, I can't do that.
It's interesting. It may be a useless analogy, but I seem to recall from one of the Civil War film reenactments where it's Gettysburg and one of the Confederate officers is asking General Pickett, the notorious General Pickett, do you really think we should obey the order to go up there and charge, you know, the high ground where the Union forces are? In this scene, he doesn't answer. He just kind of looks away. And, of course, as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah.
And something like that apparently did happen. And so these kind of non-explicit responses can really have major consequences,
right.
Can't
Absolutely.
They?
Absolutely.
They're rule-governed and systematic.
Yeah. That's a really lovely example because it's just – it's all – in that case, it's just embodied conduct. There's no – the way you put it, there's no verbal communication, but it's well known exactly what is being communicated.
We're going to look further at this phenomenon of conversation analysis when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guests, Cecilia Ford and also Douglas Maynard, and we're looking at conversation analysis, the way of determining what's really going on during a conversation, typically with two people, although obviously it gets more complicated if you have a group involved. I was just thinking about, and I don't know how they do it today, but court reporters, you know, when they're transcribing what goes on in a trial, there must be an awful lot left out, inevitably, in terms of the pauses in answers or even facial expressions. How does how do you begin to keep track of that conversation analysis through a transcription of any kind?
Well, coming from language sciences, linguistics as I did, and sociolinguistics, which was primarily quantitative when I encountered it in the 70s, although we had been influenced by Irving Goffman and Del Hines and John Gumperz, who were social scientists. And I through my graduate work with linguists who were far-reaching and sociologists at UCLA, I encountered transcription and of the what's hearable, not visible in language use. And then what dominated linguistic theory was a notion of sentences, syntax, well-formed sentences. But I quickly, through transcribing, discovered that overlaps in talk are systematic. If you tell a joke and you're after the punchline is a pause, you know the joke has bombed.
Yeah, good point. Boy, rough we to be a stand-up comic.
Yeah, we don't laugh in turns. We don't go, ha-ha, 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 ha-ha.
There actually is a game where the people do that, and it gets very funny because it's so artificial.
Yeah. So I let the sociologists, ethnomethodologists, conversation analysts teach me through transcription of the pauses and the precise moments of overlap what the units of language were for the actual users of language, humans, not armchair people, scholars thinking up well-formed sentences. So I got really into turn-taking and how it defined, and we had to have a linguistics that paid attention in core ways to what was being defined by pauses and overlaps.
Yeah, and we have much writing about our transcription conventions, but there's really just a very few, but they're very revealing as to what their importance is. So we have conventions for marking overlapping speech. And one reason that's interesting is because given the turn-taking that we do that Cece was talking about earlier, in fact, often one speaker will overlap the end of an utterance from another speaker. It's rare when it's actually interruptive. We're fairly definitive about what constitutes interruption as opposed to overlap. Overlap is very regular. So we mark where a piece of one person's turn is overlapping with another person's finishing turn. We measure silences in terms of tenths of a second. You know, a one-tenth of a second silence is very, very regular between turns. a 1 second silence is much less regular. As it gets beyond one second, people begin to make inferences as to why this person is delaying their turn.
Yeah, it comes up in broadcasting all the time.
I bet.
More than 2 seconds and you're in trouble.
And we indicate intonation. We use conventional punctuation marks, but they, to a conversation analyst, represent other features of speech. So, for example, a question mark at the end of an utterance indicates that it was spoken with an upturn in intonation at the end of the utterance. A period indicates downward in intonation. If there's no punctuation, it just means it was pretty flat. We indicate when somebody begins to speak loudly. Like that utterance, we would put in the word loudly in capital letters. We indicate emphasis. If I were to say that is really important, we would put underlines under the word really, or at least the first part of it, because I emphasize that. We indicate breathing. We indicate in-breaths, out-breaths, because all of this is significant to how we understand one another. And so the conversation analyst wants to get a hold of how people understand one another, and so that's why we go into great detail with these transcripts.
And in terms of interpreting the action of a pause or developing pause, it takes very long, 600 milliseconds to plan sentence or turn it talk, but it on average it doesn't go over 200 milliseconds for the next person to talk. So the person who's speaking the turn and responding to the action of that turn has to be being analyzed by the respondent in the time that the turn is being formed. It can't be that I package my action and give it to you, Norm, and you open it and comprehend it and then respond to it in a turn.
Interpreting and analyzing as you talk. I'm actually maybe not strictly doing two things at once, but flipping back and forth very quickly between listening to you and thinking how I'm going to respond.
Yes.
Exactly.
Right. And that allows us to analyze as participants in conversation how long the pause is as indicating a possible disagreement or how soon the next turn is taken or in overlap as completing an action which is enthusiastic about our joke or delayed and unenthusiastic in disagreement.
Yes, that's intriguing because we're talking about, it seems to me, kind of this spectrum of time. So if you imagine what you're saying, Cece, as a line on a computer like we see audio now, and then you think of my response as another line on the computer, if they overlap, you know, two channels overlapping, so to speak, there's one thing going on, but if there's a little gap, there's something else. If there's a long gap, I might be counting to 10 before I lose my temper.
Yeah, right. And if we were able to comprehend each other's actions and talk simultaneously, which we are, then why is it we don't talk at the same time like a fax machine of emitting words at the same time? And I think there's a Star Trek episode about that. It's the binars. If you Google binars on Star Trek, you will see that. But we can't show that we are our understanding of what action you just did if we don't delay our incoming turn. It allows us inner subjectivity.
We have to absorb it before we can respond to it.
Well, we show that we've absorbed it by taking turns.
Well, I guess there is, but there is another component to that, which has come up, I'm sure, in many a marriage in particular, and that is you weren't paying attention to what I was saying, were you? Because you're responding to something that I've said without indicating that you understood what I was saying.
Yeah.
Exactly. We call it giving a display of understanding. And
that's a good
one. If you're listening to somebody and you're taking the next turn of talk, it is required of you as the recipient of that other turn to display that you understood that turn before you go on and say whatever you want to say. And there are, as you, the example you gave, there are times when people don't do that, and it's very troublemaking. I also wanted to say that following on what Cece was saying, is that this matter of projecting when a current turn of talk is going to end is extremely important, and the way that it occurs varies by culture. So English is a very good language for doing turn projection, because early on when somebody is taking a turn of talk, you can right away begin to project when this turn is going to end and time your taking a next turn very precisely relative to their ending. It so happens that's because the early part of the turn is already giving an indication of where it's going. In languages like Japanese, it's not the same. Japanese speakers produce what are called particles at the very end of a turn of talk that can change the understanding of what this current turn of talk is doing. And so Japanese speakers have to listen very carefully all the way through the turn to know exactly how to respond. So it's a real interesting
thing. That's the way grammar can be informing of informative of language variation. What language resources you have as a Japanese speaker allow you to confirm at the end of your turn that it's a and or because. And in English, we generally put those conjunctions at the start of our turns, because and
starts a lot of sentences.
Yeah.
And in German, well, wait till the end of the sentence because I haven't gotten to the verb yet.
Yeah, uh-huh. Right.
Exactly. That's
That's true of many languages.
Yeah.
However, I would think in any of these languages, there could be some ambiguity if the person speaking stops for a couple of seconds to think of the next word or the next tack of the sentence, and the other person, maybe it wouldn't happen in Japanese the way you describe it, but the other person thinks you're done and or you're just trailing off, you know, dot, dot, dot. And so it's time for me to speak. And the other person says, wait a minute, I haven't finished yet. I mean, so there is still, seems to me, some ambiguity there.
Yeah.
Ambiguity and flexibility.
Variation.
Yeah.
Well, what else have you found in your research then of all these components of language and interactions in conversations? And does it get hopelessly complicated if you have more than two people in a conversation?
Well, right now we have more than two people.
But you're very polite people and you've studied this.
Well, you're doing a role. You're acting in a role of interviewer And we are acting in the roles of interviewees. And we could ask you questions and break the format. But we are forming our social roles by and through the talk. So
that's a good point. And it's also illustrative of conversation analysis began as focusing on what are otherwise called casual conversations. And we now refer to it as ordinary talk. But of course, talk occurs in many different arenas, different settings, different institutions.
Ritual talk.
And there's almost like a branch of conversation analysis that's concerned with what we call institutional talk.
So there are, I can imagine.
There are studies of courtroom interactions. There are studies of doctor-patient interactions.
Classroom.
I've done some of those. Classroom interactions. CC has studied meetings of various kinds and multi-party meetings, and this stuff is very, very interesting. And I'd say to CC's credit, I mean, she's also an expert on phonology and the paralinguistics of talk, but has also done these wider studies of meetings and things like that. And I've studied doctor-patient interaction, recently did a study of the testing and diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. I've studied plea bargaining. Like I said, there's studies of courtroom interaction. There's a lot of studies of news interviews. Cece and I, neither of us have participated in those so much, but out at UCLA, they have a whole arena of news interview studies, and very interesting. So it's not just casual conversation. It's also conversations that have real import in the wider social world, so to speak.
We're going to look further at conversation analysis and find out how it might apply to your everyday life when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guests, Cecilia Ford and Doug Maynard, and we're looking at conversation analysis and all of the subtexts and nuances to a conversation between two people, or in some cases, more than two people, where it gets quite interesting and complicated sometimes. You mentioned earlier, Doug, a conversation type between doctor and a patient. So first of all, what would be the dynamics of the relationship and how does it play out in a conversation?
Well, a typical doctor-patient interaction, or a patient coming for regular medical care, let's say an internal medicine clinic, the patient will bring a primary concern, as it's called, and of course wants to have attention to that primary concern. But often they bring other kinds of concerns and are hopeful that maybe the doctor can say something about those. So our colleagues at UCLA, John Heritage and Jeff Robinson, did a study where they interviewed patients before they were to see their doctors, and they asked them to list what their main concern was and then other concerns that they might also have that they would perhaps like the doctor to address. And then they did a very interesting manipulation, which is that they asked some of the doctors at the end of the interview to ask their patient, do you have some other concerns? Or other doctors were told to ask their patients, do you have any other concerns? And what they found is that when the doctor asked do you have some other concerns after the interview was coming to a close, they would get a number of other things that the patient was worried about.
Something more specific that they're fishing for.
Yeah, or something that isn't their main concern, but they'd still like to have the doctor know about it. But when they asked the question, do you have any other concerns as opposed to some other concerns, that patients heard that as, well, this interview is coming to a close, and they didn't report their additional concerns. You know, and I tell my students about this, and I give the example of when a student comes to my office and they've been taking up a lot of time, I might ask them, like, is there anything else? And it helps to close down the conversation. But just that little variation.
That's a fascinating nuance. And, I mean, we tend to assume when we talk about, at least when I hear about these conversation analyses, that each of the people in the conversation knows exactly the right word to use at the right time for the right effect. But that's so often not the case, isn't it?
Yeah.
And any little spin can be just misinterpreted or interpreted in an unintended way, which gets me into the workplace, CC.
In my workplace, once I got tenure, I got on the committee for women of the faculty senate and met immediately colleagues in sciences and medicine. And among those were Molly Carnes and Joe Handelsman. And Joe is now the director of Institutes of Discovery. But they were hatching a NSF grant to understand the biases against women in sciences and underrepresented fields, where women were underrepresented. And from what I shared in that meeting, the meeting of the Committee on Women, they invited me to cross-linguistically collaborate with them on the study of women in science and engineering and medicine STEM fields. And they asked me specifically to ground their understanding of why women had the experience or reported the experience of having their ideas ignored or attributed to a male colleague in workplace meetings. And I took that on, although it was daunting to me how I would get into meetings and videotape them. But I did, and I found that women were doing the same things as men, and it was just the problem of the bias that's against women as authorities. And we women and men both hold these biases. But I did notice that some of the fundamental things we had discovered about ordinary conversations held true in the meetings. And that was that when you leaned forward and acted like you were wanting to talk, you got the floor and you got people gazing at you. And when you asked a question, this had been a basic finding of early CA, that when you ask a question, often it comes back to you after the answer to that question, why did you ask? And you get the next turn in the course of action, joint action. So I wrote a chapter in my book, Women Speaking Up in Workplace Meetings, about questions as a way in. And I found that women had a better chance of getting the floor, as do men, when they ask a question versus when they make a statement or proclamation.
Kind of a Socratic method, isn't it?
Yeah.
It kind of puts you on alert to come up with an answer as the hearer.
Right. And it gives the turn back to the questioner. And early studies of language and gender in the 60s and 70s said that women were more likely to ask questions. And this put it in context of not asking questions because we're emanating our lack of knowledge, but asking questions to get the floor.
I would think another device that would come up in conversation could be in the courtroom, as we've talked about the courtroom, or a domestic situation. That would be the loaded question.
Mm-hmm. There have been studies of courtroom interactions that are very detailed about the way in which questions get asked, the way in which witnesses respond to those questions, and what are some of the dynamics of that kind of interaction. It has been also, another feature of what we call talk in institutional settings is it often has a different kind of turn-taking than what we use in ordinary conversation. So the courtroom is a good example of that.
I would think also in an interrogation, sometimes a conversation is or turns into an interrogation, and that would have a whole different dynamic in the communication too, wouldn't it?
Yes. There are studies of, for example, police interactions with civilians who've been stopped for putative traffic violations or issues. So there's many domains in which those kinds of question-answer sequences can be interesting. Again, I've done some studies myself with colleagues where we've studied police stopping individuals, not necessarily driving, but stopping individuals on the street. Or one instance is at the school where they're dealing with autistic individuals. And it's the case that up until recently, at any rate, police don't get much training in how to orient their actions to individuals who might be on the autism spectrum. And the police then can interpret actions on the part of an autistic individual as certain kinds of resistances that were not intended that way. So there's that, and there's also studies that have to do with police interactions with differently raced people, if
right.
You can use that phrase. And that,
and
those
there's
are very important.
Studies of escalation and de-escalation of what leads to escalation in terms of force and what leads to de-escalation and lack of force. And that's been out of UC Santa Barbara and Jeff Raymond.
Mm-hmm.
And we see, yes, and hear more about de-escalation these days, too. It's been a fascinating and polite conversation. Cecilia Ford and Doug Maynard.
Thank you very much.
I'm Norman Gilliland. Our engineer is Lee Rayburn, and I hope you'll join us next time around for University of the Air.